Today on Against the Grain, did Charles Darwin influence Karl Marx?
In the book called On the Origin of Species of 1859, the object of analysis for Darwin is the form of life, namely the species. And the question that Darwin sat out to answer in that book is, how is it that one form of life or one species emerges from another? Marx read that and said, that really clarifies what I'm doing in this book called Capital. I'm going to explain how some social formations emerge out of different social formations, how it is that capitalism emerged from something that used to be called European feudalism, and that once it did so, went global, so to speak, and came to dominate, well, life all around our planet today.
Joel Wainwright argues that how Marx came to conceive of historical change has bearing on how we meet the ecological crisis today, and he reflects on the potential role of strikes and boycotts in moving beyond capitalism. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Marx has frequently been characterized as a determinist, one who saw history passing through fixed stages on the inevitable march toward emancipation. In the end, Marx, Darwin, and the natural history of the climate crisis, my guest Joel Wainwright takes issue with that characterization and argues that Marx's ideas about historical change owe a debt to the ideas of Charles Darwin, including about the importance of chance or randomness. Joel, I guess we should start with this term, natural history, which conjures up Victorian-era museums of fossils and other creatures. What does natural history mean, or what should it mean for us today as we try to make sense of capitalism?
Part of the argument of the book is that natural history is a discipline, and a rather peculiar one, which is going to have a very good future. We're at a moment where we need to be thinking naturally historically, to use the old adjectival form of it. We need a natural historical Marxism, is one of the central claims of the book. So why would we want such a thing, and what would that look like? Well, natural history as a discipline, prior to the late 19th century, used to be this very broad, capacious science or field of study. If it was a discipline, it was a very quirky one because it was essentially anti-disciplinary, in the sense it didn't do what we tend to think disciplines do now, which is to limit knowledge and specialize how we study objects. Because if you think about it, what is the object of natural history? It encompasses everything, all of nature and all of history. And the beauty of natural history broadly defined is that it focuses our mind on a very elemental truth, which is that all nature is historical, and all history is natural. And so as I want to revive the term, that's what I mean. Natural history means taking nature as historical and taking history as natural, and thinking those two phenomena as one. So the really interesting question then, I suppose, is why bring Marx into the conversation? There's many reasons for that, but is that that's where the man Karl Marx ended up in 1860. As he was sitting down to write the book called Capital, his grand analysis of capitalist society. And the reason he came to that is because he read Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, which had been published in 1859. In the winter of 1860, Marx, when he was convalescing from illness, read Darwin, and it really blew his mind. And then when he sat down to write Capital, he described it, of all things, as a work of natural history.
So how did Marx see the relationship between humans and the rest of nature, that often gets seen as history versus nature, before his encounter with Darwin?
Well, when he was a young man in the 1840s, Marx spent quite a bit of time thinking about this question. And when he was living in Paris in 1844 and 1845, he filled some notebooks around related themes. And those notebooks, which are now called Marx's Paris Manuscripts, tend to be read as a kind of departure from the philosopher Hegel. Now, I won't go too deep into this because I don't want to put your non-philosophy sort of minded listeners to sleep. And at any rate, debates about Hegel among Marxists can get pretty esoteric quickly. But suffice to say that One of the important points of departure from Hegel, his teacher, that really defines the work of the young Marx, is his criticism of Hegel for not paying close enough attention to nature and the real history of people's life on Earth in developing a philosophy of history, and a history of philosophy, I might add. So Hegel had given a series of lectures on the philosophy of history and another series of lectures on the history of philosophy, and written some very important works that essentially thought deeply about those topics. And Marx comes along as his student a generation later and says, you know, my teacher had some brilliant things to say, but it was all highly abstract. The categories that he used were abstracted away from real history, people's history. And if you look at the real history of humanity, what you are talking about, says Marx, is a process whereby human beings evolve on Earth and transform nature, and in so doing, change themselves. And that's all missing from Hegel, he says. Well, when I put it that way, the modern listener is thinking, well, that kind of sounds like Darwinian anthropology. And it is actually quite extraordinary how in 1844 to 1845, some of Marx's language and intuitions seem to anticipate what we now associate with thoughts about the evolution of humanity. But unfortunately for Karl Marx, at that point in time, no one in the world had a real scientific basis for theorizing the natural history of humanity, except Charles Darwin, who at the very same moment, in which I regard as kind of extraordinary, kind of incredible symmetry, was in London writing his notebooks. He had already completed the famous voyage on the Beagle, where he was working out his theory of evolution and natural selection. And upon reading The Origin of Species, Marx immediately dashed off a pair of letters to two of his friends in which he said, this is the book that provides the natural historical foundation for my conception of the world.
Well, how was that publication, when it did happen, of Darwin's On the Origin of Species received at the time of its publication in 1859? How did it upend the prevailing way European intellectuals saw the world?
The publication of On the Origin of Species in 1859 was a shattering event in intellectual history, I think, for all of humanity. It remains a deeply challenging book. Freud would later say that there were a trio of events in human history that had really displaced the ego. And the first of those was the displacement of the idea that the universe is centered upon Earth, and in fact, the Earth is just a planet that revolves around the sun. The second was Darwin's discovery that humans were just another species which had evolved through the course of natural history on the same Earth. And of course, Freud, since he had a bit of an ego himself, put his own discovery of the subconscious as the third great decisive event. But putting that aside, I think Freud was right about Darwin. It's really actually amazing how even today in 2025, there is, for instance, in our society, Sasha, in the United States, there's still a deep antipathy towards the idea that human beings evolved from other species. It's a very challenging thought for many people, for whom the idea that humans were not, for instance, created by God as humans, but were evolved from other forms of life. It's very troubling for them. But I have to insert a clarification note here, which is that precisely because he anticipated this trouble for religious-minded readers, Charles Darwin made a very important decision in the 1850s when he was working on the book On the Origin of Species, essentially to say nothing about the evolution of humanity. So for those who haven't read the great work, it's a wonderful book and highly worth reading. It still repays the time it takes to go through its pages. It's really funny in places, and there's lots of great illustrations. At any rate, Darwin in On the Origin of Species decides to just include one sentence about humans, in which he says, with time, more will be revealed about the evolution of our own species. That's all he says. And then he set the matter aside for a number of years. And it wasn't until, if my memory serves me correctly, 1871 or 72, that he came out with his great book on the evolution of Homo sapiens, or humans. the descent of man. So in that gap between 1859 and the early 1870s, there's a lag where essentially the world of readers has been exposed to a theory, a descent with modification, which can clearly explain the emergence of the human species. And everybody who was talking about Darwin in those days was speculating on the implications of his theory for our own species, of course. But Darwin hadn't published his book on humans yet. And so into that vacuum of intellectual life rushed many lesser authors than Darwin, who brought out books of mostly very poor quality that tried to fill the gap and explain how humans had evolved according to Darwin's theory. Well, one of the arguments I make in this book, The End, is that one of the ways that we have to read Marx's masterpiece, the book called Capital, is as one of those contributions to the genre of post-Darwinian studies of the evolution of humanity.
Well, and we'll return to Marx and talk extensively about the ways you think Darwin influenced his thinking in Capital. But I wanted to turn for a moment to some of those lesser writers who intervened then and later in trying to use Darwin's ideas for various purposes. You argue in your book, The End, that Darwin's ideas have revolutionary implications, and that comes through in the way Marx engaged with those ideas. But of course, Darwin has been often appropriated by the right up until our day. And there are those who've argued that Darwin provided the natural justification for social inequality and the notion that, you know, the strongest survive, and that's ultimately for the good of the species. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, those ideas termed social Darwinism were propounded by Herbert Spencer and others. Now, I'm sort of getting ahead somewhat in the chronology, but I wanted to ask you, since it's relevant to this broader discussion, why you think that that use of Darwin's ideas was broadly unfounded based on what Darwin was arguing.
Before I answer your question, it might be useful just to lay the groundwork a little bit by clarifying that Herbert Spencer was a popular philosopher in the time period when Darwin published On the Origin of Species. And in fact, by some measures, he was the most popular social philosopher in North America at the time. And he had his own, let's call it unscientific theory of evolution. And just a footnote here, there were a lot of people in the mid-19th century who were speculating on the evolution of species, not just Darwin. So Herbert Spencer had his own theory, but he was an early devotee, you might say, of Darwin's theory, and immediately wrote some works that tried to capitalize on Darwin's fame and essentially say that I, Herbert Spencer, anticipated this, and this is how it fits into my system, and so on. But Spencer made a decisive modification by introducing both a simplification of the theory and also to apply it directly to human populations. And that brings us to this phrase, which you rightly quoted, survival of the fittest, which was coined by Herbert Spencer in the 1860s, and which quickly took on a life of its own. And very unfortunately, in one of the later editions of On the Origin of Species, Darwin took that expression, survival of the fittest, and stuck it into his own book at a very important point. Even quoting Spencer and saying, in so many words, I thank Dr. Herbert Spencer for giving us this concept because it's a useful way of summing up what I'm saying. And that unfortunately amounted to a kind of authorization or endorsement of a very bad idea. And this is one reason why so many people on the left came to regard Darwinism, if not Darwin himself, quite negatively. I mean, apart from the fact that he was himself a kind of bourgeois liberal thinker, he contributed directly to this language, which you aptly described, that has done so much damage to so many people over the years. Well, without going too deep into the weeds, I'll simply say that if we look at what Charles Darwin actually wrote in On the Origin of Species, and the way it's actually informed the field of evolutionary biology, the concept of survival of the fittest makes no sense. Just to give one example, and there's several different ways we can debunk this idea, survival of the fittest, literally speaking, means that if a pair of animals mate and have several offspring, that whichever child of theirs, off whichever of the F1 generation, is most fit, however concretely that might be defined, then that's the one that's going to survive and go on to have more children. But it doesn't work like that at all in nature. Consider the following. Imagine a pair of birds are born in a nest. And suppose that there's some way of knowing, which there isn't really, but let's just bracket that problem, that one of the two birds is somehow more fit to survive and reproduce than its sibling. Now imagine that there's a hawk flying around and it sees that nest and those birds are its natural prey. So it swoops down to the nest and grabs a bird and flies away. So one of the two birds was unlucky. Does the hawk always get the bird which was less fit? Certainly not. It was a 50-50 proposition. So the point is, there are many factors in play apart from whatever abstract definition we might use again of fitness to define beings at the outset. In a word, randomness, or as Darwin puts it, chance, plays a huge role in determining life outcomes. So it's very troubling that Charles Darwin authorizes the expression survival of the fittest. It doesn't fit with his theory, and biologists have solved this puzzle by simply dropping it. So when I took evolutionary biology in college, we never talked about survival of the fittest. We certainly never talked about Herbert Spencer either. As a thinker, he's dead and gone. Nonetheless, what happened, to make a long story short, is in the late 19th and early 20th century, an extreme right-wing, racist, sexist ideology emerged, which justified the most horrendous actions later of fascism, which ostensibly grounded itself on ideas like, quote-unquote, survival of the fittest. So for good reason, I suppose, many on the left have held Darwinism with some skepticism. And this has, I think, prevented us from having a kind of honest conversation about the many ways in which, in fact, reading Darwin influenced Karl Marx a great deal.
Right, and you seek to rectify that in your book, The End, Marx, Darwin, and the Natural History of the Climate Crisis. I'm speaking with geographer Joel Wainwright. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain. So, you know, in thinking about this area where some of these ideas around nature then get utilized to justify social inequality and kind of naturalize it, I wanted to ask you, going back before both Darwin and Marx, to the contributions, if we can call it that, of the ideas of Thomas Malthus. In his 1898 essay on the principle of population, he expounded ideas that were then quite influential in the 19th century, read, of course, by both Darwin and Marx, and of course actually remain influential in our time in different guises. Often people don't necessarily even know that they're sort of carrying a torch for Malthus. What did Malthus argue about human population, and what influence did those ideas have on Darwin, and how did Marx relate to both?
It's a tricky question, Sasha, because Malthus informs Darwin directly. Malthus informs Marx directly, but Malthus also informs Marx indirectly via Darwin. And it's that last piece that I think tends to drop out of our conversation. So I'll come back to that in a moment. But briefly, Thomas Malthus was a reverend, a natural historian in his own right, and he wrote some very popular works of political economy. Undoubtedly, the best known work of Malthus is his essay on population, which can be read in different ways. I tend to be, in the book, a bit, I suppose, dismissive of it because I regard it as a ridiculous work that should never have been taken too seriously. But as many people will know, it was used as a kind of justification against what we might call today social welfare policies on the grounds that Malthus reasoned the capacity of society to provision people's needs by producing food and shelter and so forth was quite limited, and that human population would increase faster than those resources would allow, creating a kind of inevitable overpopulation. And so by the reasoning of Reverend Malthus, there was no point in trying to address the needs of the poor. You would just worsen the problem. You'd end up with even more population. And this, of course, has gone on to be used to justify all kinds of terrible anti-poor and racist ideas down through the centuries. Now, unfortunately, we might say, that this this work of Malthus did play a significant role in spurring Charles Darwin's great breakthrough. He read Thomas Malthus's essay on population, and it was one of many factors that contributed to his insight into what we now call the theory of evolution, or the theory of descent with modification. So there's a debate as to what extent Malthus influenced Darwin. I'll simply say I come down on the side that argues that the influence was fairly modest. As for Marx, Marx read Malthus like he read all the political economists of the late 18th and early 19th century during the course of his preparations for the study of capital. And Malthus is one of those figures he returns to again and again to criticize. Marx was keenly aware of the limitations of Malthus's ideas and the conservative political implications they brought. But what I find remarkable is that after he reads Darwin, he notes to himself that Darwin actually is the person who completes the critique of Malthus. And when he then goes on to write about population in the book called Capital in 1867, he significantly changes and reorganizes his presentation of those ideas. And my explanation for this is that, in part, what is going on is that reading Malthus through Darwin permits Marx to take a much more robust position vis-a-vis human population. And to put it quite formulaically, the argument that Marx arrives at in Capital goes like this, Sasha. He says Malthus erred because he had a theory of human population, which he argued was transhistorical, meaning permanent for all of human history, and was simply based on the idea that you had a linear increase over time in available resources, but an exponential increase in human population. And Darwin destroys this simple theory by showing that actually human needs and human behavior and human forms of society are all dynamic, and we can overcome apparent limitations by changing who and what we are and how we relate to the environment. Well, Marx could have said just that much, but in fact, then what he goes on to do is to make the grand conclusion of his book Capital, his analysis of the formation of capitalist society, into a new scientific theory of human population. So that work of 1867 has as one of its three conclusions a presentation of what he calls a law of capitalist society. And simply put, Sasha, the law is that, according to Marx, that over time, capitalist society will generate what Marx calls an ever-increasing surplus population. Now, superficially, a law that promises an increasing number of surplus population sounds a bit like Malthus. Because after all, Malthus was saying, we're going to have more and more poor people, excessive overpopulation, etc. But they mean two very different things. Malthus understands overpopulation in terms of the number of people you have relative to extent resources. Marx speaks of surplus population as the relative number of people who are laborers who are needed or not needed relative to the needs of capital. So it's a completely different ratio. Well, nonetheless, the two are pretty similar if you look at them in a kind of a soft light. And so it's not all that surprising, I suppose, that generations of Marxists have turned away from the so-called law of surplus population at the conclusion of the book Capital. But I think that we can no longer turn away from it, not just because it's there. Anyone who's interested in Marx has to come to terms with it. My own view is that actually the position Marx arrived at late in life was well nigh scientifically undeniable. In other words, Marx was right. And so then we have this awkward situation where Marx was influenced by Darwin and Malthus, and even though he was critical of both of them, particularly Malthus, he nonetheless changed his thinking on the basis of their works and arrived at a very difficult and troubling fact, which is that so long as we live in a capitalist society, humanity is bound to generate more and more people who are, so to speak, not needed by capital itself.
We're going to talk much more about the particulars of what Marx drew from his engagement with Darwin. But I wanted to ask you first, broadly speaking, how did that engagement shift Marx's thinking in Capital? That is, you know, you were talking about in the early Marx, the way that nature entered into his consideration of trying to well, grapple with Hegel, trying to understand capitalism. But then you argue that Capital itself, the ideas that he promulgated in Capital, indicate a kind of shift. So how would you assess the significance of his engagement with Darwin in Capital and the degree to which this awkward thing we call nature was so important to the thinking in that work?
My claim is that there are three or four core themes in Marx's critique of capitalist political economy where we can discern the mark of having read and absorbed Darwin's On the Origin of Species. And so the keywords that I study in that part are population, labor, nature, technology, value, and fetishism. So readers who are interested in those themes can check out part two, but let me try and approach the question in a slightly different way. Many of your listeners will be aware of work of scholars like Saito Koai Saito, or Jason Moore, or Andreas Malm, other ecological Marxists like myself, who have produced considerable body of work that has documented and explained the fact that during the course of his life, Karl Marx produced a theory of capitalist society, which we retrospectively call ecological. And sometimes people lump those of us who do this kind of work together. We're called ecological Marxists for this reason. Okay, so while this group of scholars has done, I think, a terrific job of explaining that, Marx produced a way of understanding the human relationship to the earth in a capitalist society, where I think, I'll say we had failed before, was explaining why Marx came to this set of ideas. And so my contribution is to say that if we look at when the transition occurs in Marx's thinking, it's hard to get around the conclusion that the decisive period of time when Marx's ideas move forward and become quote-unquote ecological is during the decade of the 1860s. And that was the clue that really got me thinking about Darwin and the relationship between Darwin and the change in Marx's thought. Because, well, anyone who reads Darwin at that point in time is going to be confronted by a theory that's going to immediately make it clear that human societies are natural and historical in a way that hadn't been thought before. Because not only does our species emerge through history, through evolution and so forth, but more generally, what it means to be human is inseparable from that long natural history of transforming natural environments which change us and so forth and so on. And when you put all that together, then you can arrive at the question, well, how did becoming capitalist change the way human societies function? How does the capitalist form of society, as a distinct natural historical form of the human species, how does that behave differently than, or shape behavior differently, let's say, than other societies that preceded it? And that is precisely the question that Marx set out to answer in 1867 in his book called Capital. So to put it quite simply, I think what I've tried to suggest is that it's only if we remember that Marx read Darwin in 1860 and said in his own words that that book provided the natural historical foundation for his critique of capitalism that we can understand how Marx's breakthrough towards ecological Marxism, or what we call ecological Marxism today, was made possible.
Geographer Joel Wainwright is my guest. We're discussing his book, The End, Marx, Darwin, and the Natural History of the Climate Crisis. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, Joel, you mentioned that, among other things, one of the places that we can see the influence of Darwin on Marx in Capital was around technology. And Marx has sometimes been characterized as Promethean, that is, as someone who thinks that humans should wield technology to dominate nature. And I wanted to ask you, how accurate do you think that assessment of Marx is, and how were his views of technology shaped by his engagement with the ideas of Charles Darwin?
The case for reading Karl Marx as a Promethean thinker has been prosecuted and counter-prosecuted in the literature, and my own view on this is that while it is certainly possible to make the argument that Marx was a Promethean thinker in his youth, and certainly up to, say, around the time of the 1850s, I don't find that conclusion at all persuasive for his most important work, which is Capital, published in 1867. Which raises an important question again, which is, what caused this change? And in the book, I argue that here too, we can see the imprint of Darwin. Now, notably, the only times that Marx directly quotes Charles Darwin in his book Capital concern technology. And there's a famous footnote where Marx writes that, in so many words, that Darwin has made us really interested in the evolution of nature's technology, by which he means how it is that distinct species evolve to have certain, so to speak, tools made of their own bodies. Like, think of the antlers on a deer, or the very precise mechanisms that allow for a particular kind of beetle's mouth to open and close in the way it does. And then Marx goes on to say, shouldn't we be able to produce such a history of human technology as well? And wouldn't that be of a special importance to us? Because if we want to explain something like capitalist society, we need to understand how technologies evolve. And in the section of Capital that follows, as I document in the book, there are a number of passages that are clearly directly influenced by Darwin. He uses metaphors that he draws from Darwin. He uses language that he draws from The Origin of Species, and so on. So that could lead someone to the conclusion that, quote, Marx is Darwinian apropos technology, but things are more complex than this. Because, as we know, human society doesn't operate in the same way that other species live their lives in ecosystems. For one thing, we have a peculiar human consciousness, but for another thing, in a capitalist society, the way we behave is fundamentally structured by specific forms of class competition, which Marx is at pains to analyze in the book called Capital.
In thinking about the different elements that you discuss in detail, and the way that we can see sort of traces of an engagement with Darwin in Marx's thinking and in Capital, I wanted to ask you, though, stepping back for a moment, about these two thinkers, two giant thinkers, operating, writing at the same time, even writing in the same city, not far from each other, how their method fundamentally differed from one another, something you note in the end.
The first thing that should be said is that both thinkers have been saddled by myths about how they worked. To start with Darwin, there's a kind of common conception that he went to the Galapagos on the ship and he saw the finches and the tortoises and then had an aha moment and went home and wrote it up. And in fact, things were more complicated than that. He was a very deliberate thinker who worked out his ideas over the course of years in these notebooks. And then even when he arrived at his theory of descent with modification, he held back from publishing those ideas for about 15 years. During that time, he spent a great deal of time doing empirical work on the evolution of barnacles to try to cultivate his understanding of how evolution worked in one particular species. I don't really feel like I have a good name for Darwin's method. And this is a contested point within the enormous literature on Darwin studies. Something similar could be said for Marx. There's a widespread belief that Marx was something like a dialectical materialist or a historical materialist. But actually, he never uses those words to describe himself. It's true that he uses the words history and matter and dialectics in various ways and phrases, but he was slow to put a name like that onto himself. And in the book called Capital, which is his masterpiece, when he finally says what his standpoint is, I have the passage here, let me read the key sentence. He writes, "Individual persons play a role here," that is in the book called Capital, "only insofar as they are the personifications of economic categories or the bearers of particular class relations and interests. My approach," writes Marx, "treats the development of society's economic formation as part of natural history, as that type of process, and no other approach does less to make the individual responsible for conditions that he remains a creature of socially." That's Paul Reiter's translation. So the point I want to emphasize is that means that Marx's object of analysis is what he calls society's economic formation, or what I call, in short, capitalism as a distinct social formation. And his method, so to speak, is to track the development of that social formation through natural history. Well, that description brings Marx very close to Charles Darwin, because in the book called On the Origin of Species of 1859, the object of analysis for Darwin is the form of life, namely the species. And the question that Darwin sat out to answer in that book is, how is it that one form of life or one species emerges from another? Because, he goes on to explain, all forms of life that we know were not created in that form, but are in fact the results of previous forms, most of which are now gone. The theory of descent with modification is Darwin's explanation of how one form becomes another form. So Marx read that and said, oh, that's a great idea, and that really clarifies what I'm doing in this book called Capital. I'm going to explain how some social formations emerge out of different social formations. So, for instance, how it is that capitalism emerged from something that used to be called European feudalism, and that once it did so become a social formation, went global, so to speak, and came to dominate, well, life all around our planet today.
Well, let me ask you more about that. So, as you're flagging, obviously, class society existed well before capitalism, and Marx wrote both about class struggle over that wider scope of class society, and then these different epochs, these modes of production during different periods, each characterized by different social relations. So, you know, feudal lords and serfs under feudalism, capitalists and wage workers under capitalism, and how one emerges out of the other. Marx has at times been criticized for characterizing this process as a kind of march from one stage to the other, heading towards sort of the highest stage. Is that an unfair criticism in your view? And how did Darwin's ideas and this idea of capital as natural history shape Marx's notion of these different epochs or modes?
I think that an argument can be made that in some of his early works, up to, again, the 1850s, Marx makes statements that do imply a kind of historical stagism, or what in technical terms we call a stadial philosophy of history, one where you have stage A leading to stage B, leading to stage C, and so on. That kind of thinking, incidentally, was very important in Enlightenment thought generally in the 18th and 19th century. And Marx's own teacher, Hegel, was undoubtedly one of the most important contributors to that. So Marx was exposed to that in his youth, and his early works exhibit a tendency towards stadial thinking. That continues all the way up, I think, until about 1857 to 1858, when in his first series of notebooks on the Critique of Political Economy, a set of works that are today called the Grundrisse by Marxist writers, Marx includes a section on the forms of society that preceded capitalism, where he uses language that is undoubtedly stadial and, I would say, teleological. That is to say, they imply a certain end or goal-directedness or telos, namely the emergence of capitalist society. Now, of course, what Marx really wanted to produce at that stage was a theory of how we would go beyond capitalism to something called communism. And I think early generations of Marxists after Marx really wanted a teleological theory of how capitalism would give rise to communism. So they were not so enthusiastic about what actually happened in the 1860s, which is that after Marx read Darwin, he drops stadial thinking cold. And in fact, he specifically tells his friend Engels that the thing that he likes most about Darwin is that Darwin undermines teleology for once and for all. Well, let's take a minute to see why that's the case. As is well known, the most famous achievement of the book On the Origin of Species from 1859 was to lay out the mechanism of evolution of species, namely natural selection. Okay, today we know that that's not the whole story, but that's what Darwin knew, so let's leave it at that. Well, there's a second achievement to the book, which isn't so well known, and is arguably even more radical. For natural selection to operate on a population, there have to be variations or differences among the members of the population. Where do those differences come from? No one had answered that question before Darwin wrote about it in 1859. And although he's not terribly direct about it, at one point in the text, he does provide his answer. And he says, they emerge from chance, what he calls chance. Today, we would be more inclined to use the word randomness because of the development of the field of biology and evolutionary biology and understanding today of all of the processes at a genetic level that make the formation of differences precisely random. But to stay with Darwin's language, what that means is that behind the evolution of forms of life lies chance. And when Marx read that, he must have thought to himself, and here I admit I'm speculating, but I think on good grounds, he must have thought to himself that what was true for Darwin in the evolving formation of species would also be true for human history at some level, that there must be this element of chance which lies at the foundation of the changing forms of society that unfold through time. That doesn't mean we can't study the process and try and explain it. Quite the contrary, we still need to do so, but we have to do so with an understanding that fundamentally chance plays an essential role. Well, the implication of that key insight, is that there's no longer any possibility of teleology. There's no longer any possibility of positing an underlying goal to human history and stepping back from it as a philosopher of history and saying, but when we reflect on the whole process, we can see that all along we see reasons unfolding towards emancipation. That was Hegel's answer. Or we see that all of human history was directed by God towards the end of greater holiness or goodness or something like that. What the best we can do is to try and provide a rational scientific account of how and why things unfolded as they did, but without teleology. And so what happens then for Marx is that he spends essentially the next 30 years of his life trying to understand the ecological character of different forms of society. He studies world history, producing literally thousands of pages of manuscript notes about the history of different communities and societies in different parts of the world. He takes a keen interest in the ethnology of indigenous communities. He radically rejected, for once and for all, any teleological explanations of the unfolding of human life.
Going to the broader implications of seeing things in those terms, I wanted to raise a question that you raise in the latter part of your book, The End, Marx, Darwin, and the Natural History of the Climate Crisis, which is, if we're to consider capitalism from the standpoint of natural history, as Marx then does in Capital, does that mean that capitalism is natural? Which obviously seems highly contradictory, since we know how capitalism lays waste to living things. And what does seeing capitalism from the point of view of natural history imply about its beginnings and end?
On one hand, I think it's simply undeniable that we have to accept the proposition that capitalism is natural, because once you define capitalism, as I do, following Marx, as a distinct social formation whereby human life is organized in quite specific ways on Earth, then it has to be something natural because human beings are natural and the Earth is natural. And so by that thinking, it's only logical that we should say there's something natural about capitalism. But on the other hand, anyone who takes a serious look at what's been happening to the human relationship to the Earth in the last couple of centuries since we reorganized life in capitalist form, or anyone who looks, for instance, at the climate crisis today, or the crisis of the sixth great extinction, which we're living through, can only come to the conclusion that there's something profoundly unnatural about capitalism, that it's a way of organizing human life that lays waste to the earth and deepens the separation that we experience between ourselves and natural existence on earth, and that has terrible consequences for just about every species on earth. So how do we make sense of this antinomy? Well, there's a limited number of ways to do so, both philosophically and conceptually. And what happens if we adopt this Marxian natural historical perspective? And then the solution falls out quite naturally, which is to say that what we need to do is to grasp capital not as quote unquote natural or unnatural, but as a specific natural historical form of human society, which has specific consequences. And that gives us a handle on how to think about where we are today, which is in a very dangerous moment. So in short, the answer to the question is that capital is not really natural or unnatural. It is a specific form of human society which emerges through natural history, but which, we need to overcome as quickly as possible, because otherwise the consequences will be terribly grave.
Well, let me end by asking about overcoming capitalism, which for at least those of us on the left seems incredibly urgent and transparently dangerous, and you know, the implications seem really laid out there. I wonder, though, if you think that the ideas that you've been talking about of rooting a Marxist analysis in natural history, as Marx did in Capital, helps us in any way in the predicament that we find ourselves in thinking about how to bring an end to capitalism, and if there are any implications for life beyond it.
Well, I certainly hope so, Sasha. I've been involved on the left as an activist off and on for decades now, and one of the things that I've found over the years is that as things become more and more bleak, people need clarity about the big picture, for lack of a better word. You know, what are we doing? And how is it that we should orient ourselves to the current crisis? So as a writer, in working on this book, I'm not coming to Darwin and Marx only because I'm interested in 19th century intellectual history, but because I share the passions of my comrades and fellow activists on the left in trying to think clearly about the situation we're in and where things are going. So the book was motivated in part by an attempt to orient us. So I hope that it offers something to my readers in that regard. But I do conclude the book with some lessons, I might put it that way. At the most general level, one of those is to try and give some language to what it is I think we're trying to do. And here there's a departure from the old Marxist-Leninism, which was so important and influential for generations of leftists, because instead of saying that capitalism is a mode of production which needs to be overthrown by means of the state, I am suggesting that the late Marx conceived of capitalism as a social formation which needed to be transformed. And it needed to be transformed through what he called associationism, which would give rise to simultaneous world revolution. So just from the words I've just used, the listener can probably get a sense that I'm proposing a different conception of what a revolution looks like. I think we already have the tools in hand that we need to make dramatic changes in our social formation. Let me just mention two very familiar practices and to try and connect them to what I've been saying about Darwin and Marx. The two tools I'm thinking of are the strike and the boycott. If we ask ourselves, what is a strike? A strike means that human beings who have been cast into this role by natural history of spending their lives selling the commodity labor power essentially say, I'm not going to do that right now. I'm not going to sell the labor power commodity today and tomorrow too. I'm not going to do it until a certain change is made that I want to see. So that's a strike, the interruption of the sale and use of the labor power commodity. As against this, then you have the boycott or the refusal to buy. When we refuse to buy something, whether it's gasoline or meat or what have you, essentially what we're saying is, I refuse to play the role of the proletarian consumer who works and sells her or his labor power in order to earn money so that I can then go and buy the commodities that I need to meet my needs. Well, these are very familiar tools. If you put the two of them together, though, if you have a mass strike and a large-scale boycott occur at the same time, then the circuit of capital is interrupted. So to interrupt the circuit of capital, that is to say, to cause capital to stop doing what it does, its inherently expansionary, accumulation-oriented social drive, in a sense, quote, all we need to do, unquote, is have a large-scale strike and boycott. But that's always been challenging for the left because it introduces very serious collective action problems. And for instance, we have to think ahead to, well, if we all stop working tomorrow and stop buying tomorrow, who's going to take care of my kid? Like, what's going to make sure that the kindergarten stays operational? And am I going to be able to feed my family healthy and nutritious food and so on? So we obviously have to be forming alternative networks and systems of exchange to make sure that needs are met prior to the mass strike and boycott. But that kind of thinking then allows us to see what it would mean to change our social formation without necessarily involving, for instance, armed struggle leading to the overthrow of a government, leading to the smashing of capitalism as a mode of production. In a sense, we can imagine revolutionary transformations occurring in a space that's more proximate to our ordinary lives today. But of course, if we're honest, if your listeners, for instance, in Northern California got together and had a general strike and stopped buying fossil fuels, for instance, and organized themselves in a way to meet their needs without capital, once things started to scale up, we can be sure that that would be very threatening to wealthy people and the state, and there would be a backlash. The police would be coming in with their guns and batons and so forth and so on. So there would also have to be, simultaneously, similar struggles playing out in other parts of the world, and all of that would have to be somehow connected and ramify through some kind of mechanism that would prevent the capitalist state from simply smashing all of these experiments in a radical reformation of life. So that, I think, brings us to this rather remarkable idea that Karl Marx arrived at of simultaneous world revolution, which has been elaborated brilliantly by a philosopher who deeply influenced this particular book, whose name is Kojin Karatani. And his idea of the formation of a radical new world society along the lines of associations at the end of a simultaneous world revolution. So for more on that, I would invite the reader to read the last chapter of the book. But as a concluding thought, I'll say, despite the fact that the title of the book is called The End, that's intended as a kind of joke, because the book is really about the concept of the end. It's about the concept of teleology, which was so completely destroyed by Darwin and which led to this great transformation of Marxist thought. But it's important to say that we're not really at the end just because things are bleak. More the opposite. We have to remember that every apparent ending is also a beginning, a potential new beginning.
And that is a good way of ending this program. Joel Wainwright, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks so much for your interest in my book, Sasha. I appreciate it.
I've been speaking with Joel Wainwright about his book, The End, Marx, Darwin, and the Natural History of the Climate Crisis. He's the author of various books, including Climate Leviathan, which he co-authored with Jeff Mann. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.